AM 950, the progressive voice of Minnesota, Brett Johnson with you on a Tuesday afternoon. And as usual on Tuesdays, we are joined by Patrick Coulican, who is the editor-in-chief of the Minnesota Reformer, as we're going to be talking about some of the stories that they've been working on, including this discipline dump that we just received from the Minneapolis Police Department. Dina Winter has five takeaways from that discipline dump that we'll be talking about. We will also be talking about Steve Drazkowski and his idea talking about how immigrants are apparently squatting in houses around Minneapolis, even though that's not necessarily true. We'll talk about that, as well as Patrick's column about local control and how many local cities are trying to use zoning ordinances and kind of technicalities to prevent affordable housing units from being built in their areas. So, Patrick, thanks so much for coming back on the show today.
Always a pleasure.
Absolutely. I want to start off talking about this report we received, or talking about the Minneapolis Police Department discipline dump that Dina Winter had a chance to write about, as she had five takeaways from this discipline dump that we just received. And basically what we learned from this is that, well, while some officers were disciplined, many others ended up leaving the force before their investigations were completed. And that includes one person that I think we're kind of familiar with, or at least people who listen to our show and our conversations, and that is Andrew Battelle, Sergeant Andrew Battelle, who was part of the SWAT team that ended up assaulting Jaleel Stallings in the aftermath of the George Floyd murder protests back in 2020. And at least my initial reaction as I was reading through what Dina wrote on this, Patrick, was how much things could have changed if, well, Jaleel Stallings really didn't appeal the initial charges that were against him and have a good attorney. Because from what I read through, obviously, the Minneapolis Police Department and their SWAT team really didn't follow any protocols whatsoever in this Jaleel Stallings case. And as we even look at Andrew Battelle, he's largely getting away unscathed because he left the force. So it's kind of shocking what could have happened if, well, Stallings had ended up not appealing what happened to him with the charges that were originally filed.
Yeah, from start to finish, this was bad procedure and misconduct on the part of a number of officers. They're riding around in a white unmarked van. They didn't announce themselves. And then they were just shooting it at civilians willy-nilly who were out after curfew. Stallings, an Army veteran, he had a permit for his gun. He thought he had listened to the governor of the state of Minnesota say that there are white supremacists roaming around the city. And so he thought he had been shot with a live round. He shot back. Once they piled out of the van and announced that they were police, he dropped his weapon. And they proceeded to beat him up anyway, including a fractured eye socket. They never actually filled out a use of force report on that incident, even though broken fractured his eye socket. There was another man there. They also beat down pretty well. And again, no use of force report until they were told that they had to do one. And as you said, there was all kinds of media originally around when there was media reports that that Jaleel Stallings had tried to kill police officers. Of course, what we learned later in the trial and from police body cam video was that the police account was just wrong. It was completely wrong, and Stallings was acquitted by a jury of his peers. And like you said, it's a good thing that he was able to afford a good lawyer who put up a strong defense, and he was acquitted. And then, even after he was acquitted, it wasn't until Dina Winter reported all of this, I think some weeks later, that the Minneapolis Police Department began an investigation. And so then they issued some discipline, but as you say, officers that left the force, some of them, by the way, received workers' comp or a duty disability retirement. They'll face no discipline, and then the other interesting thing here is that these events took place in May and early June of 2020. It's now 2024. So that's how long it takes to get the discipline meted out and to go through all of the appeals process. I think it strikes the average person as far too slow of a process. And in the process, what it translates into is that we have officers on the force historically who should have been disciplined much faster, including terminated. And as a result, bad stuff can happen in the meantime.
And we did have, at least as I was reading through what Dina wrote, we did have at least, well, interim chief at the time, Amelia Huffman, at least tried to discipline some of the officers. And then we also had another case of Sergeant Ronald Stevenson, who was a longtime officer who was fired back in April of 2021 after pepper spraying a Vice News reporter who had his hands up yelling press. But those seem to be more the exception to the rule. And even when you have interim chief Huffman trying to discipline these officers, it's very difficult to do. And as we talked about, it's a very, very lengthy process. And at the end of the day, if you end up leaving the force, oftentimes you're going to get away largely without facing any consequences whatsoever. And in fact, you could even still get some of that workers' comp money as you even leave the force. So that's kind of what I took away as well, is that if you are going to be under investigation, you might as well just leave the force, because there's a good chance you could probably still at least get some workers' compensation and then not end up facing any legal consequences.
Yeah, and we found that repeatedly. And that's another aspect of Dina's reporting the last 2 years, or the hundreds of officers who have left MPD, and a lot of them with those settlements for post-traumatic stress disorder. So it's hit the city coming and going, because they've had to make significant payments and settlements to demonstrators, members of the media, other folks who were the mistreated in the days after the Floyd murder. And then on the other side, they're having to make these payouts to the office, some of the officers who are leaving, and making the PTSD claims. So it's a big mess, and we again await the supervision of the United States Department of Justice.
And we wouldn't even know about many of these findings if not for the great reporting that Dina and the rest of you did over at the Minnesota Reformer. So we've only scratched the surface of what Dina wrote about today, again, titled Five Takeaways from the MPD Discipline Dump. Make sure you go check that out over at MinnesotaReformer.com. Want to move on now and talk about right-wing conspiracy theories, because this seems kind of fitting in light of all Republicans trying to highlight chemtrails last week. Well, we have another right-wing conspiracy, and this one is from Steve Draskowski, who thinks immigrants are trying to squat in Minnesota housing units and therefore are contributing to the affordable housing crisis in Minnesota. As a heads up, that's really not true. But this all stems from this Minnesota Senate bill that is being debated right now, and I believe was actually passed. It's called this Tenant Bill of Rights, which gives the tenants the rights, among other things, to organize, codify renters' rights to call emergency services without retaliation, outline remedies for tenants who can't move into their apartments on time due to construction, and it also allows individual taxpayer identification numbers to be used in place of Social Security numbers on rental applications, which is significant for people who are immigrants to this country. But Steve Draskowski, as I talked about, from this bill, somehow thinks that immigrants are squatting in Minnesota houses and therefore taking away housing options for many Minnesotans, but not necessarily true. But I'm curious, where is he getting this from, Patrick? Where is he pulling this information? Because I find it interesting that this is coming in light of Republicans talking about chemtrails, as we seem to be going down a lot of these very right-wing conspiracy theory holes with many of these Republicans in the legislature over the past few weeks.
Yeah, one of the things that we consider a service to our readers is educating people about, normal people, about some of the kind of fever fantasies of the right wing and where they're coming from. And if you follow right wing media, and it's kind of bled into mainstream media in recent weeks, you'll see a lot of coverage of the threat of squatters, which is not to say that it's not a thing, and there are squatters that would sometimes wind up in abandoned buildings, especially, and that's unsafe. But the claim here is that people are crossing the border and, like, going into, they're going to be in your suburban home while you're on vacation, and you won't be able to remove them when you get back. It's ridiculous on its face. But it's kind of a great fear-based campaign, and it has a lot of roots in Libs of TikTok, which is kind of a famous social media account on the right. I think somebody made a video where he says, you know, come to America and you can just stay in people's houses and they can't kick you out. And Steve Drazkowski is a state senator, previously served in the House, where he formed his own kind of little Freedom Caucus there. And he's very plugged into the latest right-wing media frenzy and trend. So he picked this up and tried to make an issue out of it yesterday. I think Minnesotans can rest easy that squatters are not on the hunt to move into your house while you're on vacation. If you have a problem with people trying to live in your house, you'll be able to remove them pretty easily.
I think a police call would very much take care of that problem. But I guess if you were on a 15-year vacation, maybe squatters could take over, because at least according to Minnesota law, a person trying to claim property through our state's adverse possession law must have lived on the land for 15 years before they can claim it as their own. And can't say I have experience dealing with that, but I imagine there would be a little more involved in that than just living somewhere for 15 years and then saying it's your own. So, and by the way, there were no provisions with squatters' rights in this Minnesota Tenant Bill of Rights as well. So, yes, largely just pulled from conspiracy theories, as we so often see from the right wing, especially at the Minnesota State Legislature. You can read more about that and what Drazkowski was talking about over at MinnesotaReformer.com, MinnesotaReformer.com. And before we have to wrap things up, I do want to talk about your column, Patrick, because this piggybacks about what we talked about last week with trying to build affordable housing around the metro area, and how oftentimes we have local cities put in different ordinances or zoning regulations that largely prevent these affordable housing units from, well, getting built. And your title of the column is "Don't Trust the Locals. The Failure of Land Use Reforms at the Legislature is a Major Missed Opportunity." And what this bill at the legislature was going to do until, well, many of the legislatures got cold feet, was that it was basically going to give property owners more freedom to do with their land what they want, as the bill would ensure people could build duplexes and townhomes as well as bigger apartment complexes near transit, would also stop cities from acquiring minimum lot sizes in certain building materials for aesthetic reasons, which can drive up the cost of the building. So there were many other provisions as well that could have, well, made it cheaper to build affordable housing units, but oftentimes, as we talked about last week, local cities can put up different regulations and ordinances that make that very difficult to do. But you think this is a major missed opportunity from the state legislature, and it kind of was, because like many other states, including California and others, granted we don't have the same degree of problem in California in terms of affordable housing, this could have been a major step to trying to, well, reduce housing costs for people trying to build affordable housing. But it's interesting that it is kind of these local cities that are standing in the way sometimes, and they still do hold a lot of sway with members of our state legislature, both Republicans and Democrats.
Yeah, there was a lot of excitement and I think momentum going into the session about some statewide land use reforms. And as you said, they would override local cities' attempts to prevent development, whether it's affordable housing or even just market rate regular apartments and housing, which they do because if you create scarcity, it drives up values. So, you know, if you're in Edina, you don't want affordable housing near you. But for that matter, you don't really want a whole lot of development that could drive down any property values at all. So the idea here was, let's make it easier to build. Let's get rid of minimum parking requirements. As you said, some of these building materials, mandated building materials that are really just for aesthetics, all kinds of bespoke zoning controls, so that giving really city councils the power to vote up or down on whether or not they, a developer can put an apartment building near a commercial zone or near transit, that this should be a, if somebody wants to build an apartment building in a commercial zone or near transit, they ought to be able to do that. So there was a lot of momentum. There was a really wide coalition of everybody from the Chamber of Commerce to Isaiah, which is a progressive kind of ecumenical group. And so I thought it had a lot of momentum. But those local governments and their lobbyists are really influential around the Capitol. And that's largely because I think a lot of legislators kind of view, they want to have a good relationship with the cities they represent. I understand that. I think they also view their city council members as potential opponents.
Yeah.
There was just too much opposition from local government. So it looks like they're going to have to wait on that until next year. But I think it's often the case that when you make big policy changes, you have to, it takes a few years. I think a lot of people last year kind of were deluded into thinking we can do a lot in a very short amount of time, which they did last year. But the natural order of things at the legislature is things take time. They take years. And so I think this, there are a couple provisions that might still get through. And then I think there's more to come in the future. And I think they got a good start on it this year. But again, make it easier to build. We can get more housing supply, which we need, which would stabilize prices or even bring prices down. And that would be a huge advantage for Minnesota as we try to attract people, either both to stay here and also to attract people from other places to move here, where housing costs are already lower than they are in other big states like Illinois or on the coast. And then we could drive that advantage to even greater levels. So we'll see what happens, but I think they want to make a little bit of progress this year and then come back ready for next year.
Yeah, what I find interesting about how these bills ended up largely not getting passed, at least for now, is that this really wasn't along the traditional left-right coalitions as to why a bill is not getting passed, because as you pointed out, there was a large coalition of people who wanted these bills to be built, including, as you mentioned, the Chamber of Commerce. I imagine many builders were probably in favor of this too, and I believe even some Republicans were on board. But again, still very powerful are those local city council members who, as you said, could end up being future opponents for state legislatures, and it doesn't really matter how big a coalition you have built and whether it's bipartisan or not. If you're having a threat of re-election, that sometimes can take sway. But yeah, I wasn't aware that this was such a bipartisan coalition, so you do wonder if they could eventually hold some sway in the future and try to, well, overcome the fear that, well, we're going to end up facing a primary opponent or a general election opponent that's kind of largely keeping some members a little more hesitant towards passing these types of bills and reforms.
Yeah, I think they've got the kind of coalition that can do the work in the interim between sessions to really strengthen that coalition, broaden it, and make it clear to these local governments that they need to get on board here. And legislators are more likely to listen to their concerns if they become part of the process, and then we'll see what happens next year. But I think one of the great things about having a bipartisan coalition is that it doesn't matter if the House changes hands next year. I think you're still going to see some action on this issue.
You can read more about that column called "Don't Trust the Locals. The Failure of Land Use Reforms at the Legislature is a Major Missed Opportunity." Interesting read, given that it's different dynamic than we sometimes see when it comes to local control, because oftentimes when we think about that, we think of right-wing governments in red states trying to take control of blue cities, and well, this is a little bit of a different case, so make sure you check that out over at MinnesotaReformer.com. We have been speaking with Patrick Houlihan, who is the editor-in-chief of the Minnesota Reformer, talking about some of the news and stories that they've been working on. Again, MinnesotaReformer.com. Patrick, as always, appreciate the time today.
Always a pleasure.
All right, let's take a break and send things back over to Matt McNeil on AM 950.